This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome to Elgium Talks. When people think about health in the abstract sense of the word, I mean, if they do it at all, it would rarely be in relation to property. However, real estate can have a major role to play in people's overall health in their personal lives through facilities like gyms and well-being in their professional lives through well-designed office spaces. Joining me today to explore this fascinating topic are two research strategists from our Real Assets team, Bill Page and Matt Sofair. Bill, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Matt, could you start us off? What are some hard numbers behind the current state of things?
Ultimately, stats explain the state of affairs in terms of unhealthy lifestyles in the UK far better than I could put into words. So in 2017, 29% of the UK population was classed as obese.
So a third, so basically.
Pretty much a third of the UK population classed as obese. Actually, it's not just adults, it's also children as well. So 34% of children are classed as obese by the time that they leave primary school. What that means for healthcare services is pretty stark. So in 2016, there were over 600,000 admissions relating to obesity. And actually in 2018, there were over 40,000 people who had hip or knee replacement surgery as a result of being obese.
So 40,000?
40,000. And that is a 575% increase over the past decade. So it's a huge challenge. And actually, not just in terms of those kind of more obvious impacts, but also looking at, the impact on NHS budgets. Mm-hmm. So there's a really strong correlation between obesity and diabetes. So 87% of people classed as having diabetes are also classed as overweight or obese. And that alone accounts for 10% of the NHS's budget and is forecast to grow to 17% over the next 20 years. So some big stats there, and it's clearly a big challenge for healthcare services going forward.
So that's the way things are, and I imagine that's been as you mentioned a couple of the growth indicators. It's getting worse. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So 29%, as I mentioned before, of UK adults are obese. That was around 15% in 1993. Mm-hmm. So it's a growing trend, and actually, what you find is with something like diabetes, there's a 12-year lag time between when you're diagnosed as being obese and actually when you develop, you're more likely to develop diabetes. So it's something that is, it's becoming more prominent. The fact that it's also prevalent in terms of children is also pretty pretty stark. And I guess ultimately, excuse the pun, the weight of evidence is pretty compelling.
Could you put some drivers behind this? Why is this the case?
Say probably, it's equally split between, how active people are and also what diet they have. But one of the key underlying drivers is that our day-to-day lifestyles are ultimately becoming more unhealthy. Mm-hmm. So we've got more people in the UK are employed in office-based jobs, so more sedentary jobs. Yep. Generally speaking, we eat too much. We eat 10% too many calories every day. And we don't do enough physical activity. So again, 39% of the UK population, doesn't meet the government's recommended physical activity levels. So ultimately, we're, looking at those broad trends, we're just a bit more sedentary, and that has this knock-on effect in terms of, ultimately weight and health.
I mean, to dive into a little bit, one of those points that you mentioned, the office-based job. So we are, I mean, not all of us, of course, but so many of us are just sitting at our desk, probably not even getting up enough throughout the day. I mean, it's constantly being reminded that you should really stand up, walk around for 20 minutes every hour. I mean, I can't honestly say that I do that. And I don't want to extrapolate horribly, but I don't think that many other people do that as well. Is our office design contributing to that?
Offices do have a role to play in this, Mark. So if we start at a high-level view, the number of people who work in offices has grown 80% mm-hmm. over the last 30 years. The proportion of people who work in offices has grown similarly. But offices as a corollary of that, are a more important part of UK GDP. So the output, the economic output that comes from office-based activities has grown significantly. So we need our offices, and we need people to be as productive as they can be within those offices to help with economic growth. So if we're taking a kind of cold-hearted look at all this, to be productive, you also need to be well. And as Matt was describing, a lot of being well comes from personal choices, but there are many things that the providers of office space can do to nudge people in the right direction.
What would you say, both, not to skip to the end perhaps of this episode, but what are the real investment opportunities here? Like, why does this matter to us being Legal & General Investment Management?
Starting with the office space, we are investors in office space, or perhaps more accurately, we invest other people's money into offices and curate that money as best we can. The best way to ensure outperformance or stable returns is to concentrate on buildings income. That's stable over time. That explains about three quarters of market return over time, that income point. The best way to curate that income is to make sure occupiers want to stay in your office buildings for as long as possible. And to achieve that, you need to curate the best possible environment. So we are seeing a rapid shift in recent years for more institutional owners to adapt to have a much more involved relationship with their occupiers, to make sure that over the length of a lease there's an ongoing dialogue, occupiers are using the space as effectively and productively as they possibly can, and if you succeed in making sure it's healthy, effective space and productive space, you are more likely to achieve that occupier retention, which ultimately translates to income for our investors.
Matt, how can real estate put greater emphasis on well-being from our point as an investor for communities?
So I guess one of the most interesting things about this trend that we're seeing in terms of unhealthy lifestyles is that it's not universal. Not everyone is becoming more unhealthy. Yeah. We've actually got a rapidly growing gym market. So actually the gym market in the UK has been one of the fastest growing markets over the past 5 years.
I think it's like 10 million people have gym memberships. Yeah, that's a hefty number.
Yeah, 10 million. So about 70% of the UK's active population has got a gym membership, and it's growing. So for us, as my focus is on retail and leisure real estate. So for us, that presents a great opportunity because there's a lot of new innovative concepts coming through that give us another opportunity to introduce those well-being options into our space, which again provides us with income streams, provides us with new occupiers, and it provides consumers ultimately with another reason to go and visit these locations, which typically are locations that they'd be going to visit anyway, whether it's to go to the cinema, whether it's to go to the shops, whether it's to go to the supermarket. So there's some really interesting opportunities from the occupier side there.
I'd love to delve a little bit more into that because it feels like the gyms, I mean, maybe this is because I'm looking more, having recently joined and yet not still not gone to enough of my gym membership, it feels like the gyms of today are very different from the gyms of yesteryear. And so I feel like the market's changed a lot. Has that been driven by this rise of, I don't want to call them easy gyms, but they are pay-as-you-go kind of much easier, much less fixed contract, rather than perhaps the expensive personal trainers, a high cost and high commitment. You know, it's kind of very much pay by the day kind of approach.
Yeah. So absolutely. So whenever you look at any research around why people join gyms or why people don't join gyms, the two things that always come through as being the most compelling reasons are price and access. So what we've seen by the growth of the more budget gym operators is essentially taking care of that price element of things. So actually much more affordable memberships, much more flexibility in terms of being able to cancel or pause your membership than previously gyms had in the past. And it's a natural response to consumer desires ultimately, and which is only a positive. And then the other side of things is also providing greater access by, you know, things such as 24-hour openings. We don't all work 9 to 5 in an office. Yeah. So giving people the option to go whenever they want to the gym is, again, really compelling and has helped boost the place in the market. And it's ultimately meant that the incumbents have had to up their game. We have seen almost this polarisation in the gym market where it's far more concentrated towards the budget, cheaper end, but then you are getting these great, you know, you've still got the premium options, your David Lloyd's, etc., but you've also got these more boutique studios as well, which, again, for people who want to, I guess, engage more in social fitness with other people, that's another alternative.
Would I be right in thinking of those as much more along the lines of spin class, you know, yoga, the high intensity training courses, those sort of ones?
Yeah, spin class, body pump, whatever it might be, all these classes that I don't go to. So.
And I imagine that to take this back to the investment conversation, I imagine this is a very useful way for property investors in the retail and leisure space to perhaps diversify from the more traditionally and perhaps the negative headline retail sector, the classic high street shops.
I think ultimately we have to appreciate the fact that how people shop is changing, why people go and visit different destinations is changing. People are less product orientated. So we need to provide another reason for ultimately consumers to come and visit our retail assets. And we also need new occupiers to, I guess, revitalise some of our destinations. And that's where gyms can provide a great alternative use, particularly because actually when people go to the gyms are typically potentially times of day where actually typically, say, your cinema won't be busy. So people might go during the week or during the day, whereas actually things like leisure parks might actually be far more skewed towards weekends and weeknights. So again, there's this evening out of footfall and building this kind of vibrancy across all day parts.
I mean, getting the most out of the space, I imagine, is the most important thing.
Then. Ultimately, making the space work harder.
Bill, to take this back from the personal to the professional, what is that connection between worker productivity and their workplace when they're not in their leisure time in the gym? How is being healthy helpful for investments, economic growth, and the company that they work for?
Several different scales we can examine this question from, Mark. Firstly, the economic, and Matt alluded to a lot of this. So we are a society that has a lot of days off sick. That has a cost, both in terms of days lost, but also to the NHS in terms of avoidable illness. Now, some of those are from the lifestyle side, but many of those are avoidable illnesses. So that could be musculoskeletal, so people working physically ineffectively, or, you know, contagion from colds, flus, other illnesses that can be picked up from common parts in a workplace. So solving this would do good for society. On top of that, you've got the simple point that I made earlier. To be productive at work, you need to be well. So in the office space, we have two ways of looking at this. There's absenteeism, that's people not coming to work because they're ill, and that's no good for employers or society. Or there's presenteeism, which people do come to work, but they're not feeling great and they don't do much work while they're there.
Exactly. The person next to you has a hacking cough
and
you're just trying to edge your chair slightly.
The two sick are doing any work and they just spend their day on looking at the news and then going home at 5 o'clock. And that happens a lot. And there is a financial cost to society on that. So the office space has a role to play to improving things there. Now, we're not for 1 minute saying that the office industry or office space can solve the productivity gap that the UK is suffering from, but it can give it a nudge in the right direction. So there's been several studies, and in fact, in recent years, there's been more convictional evidence about what office space can do for productivity. So numbers vary, but something like 3.5 to 5% improvements in productivity can be attained by changes in the office environment. It doesn't sound like a huge number, but if you add that across the UK economy and again, consider how many people actually work in office buildings and the contribution office buildings make to the UK economy, that 3 to 5% can make a £50 billion a year difference.
£50
billion. Yeah, which is then taxable, which then goes back into benefiting society. So it's not wrong to have these lofty ambitions about what an office building can provide. Returning to that link between health and productivity, obviously to be productive you need to be well. Does the office building make you sick? Well, yes and no. saying there's risks from office environments is not new. So we've had asbestosis, we've had sick building syndrome in the past. But what's really changed in recent years is more about the promotion of wellness rather than avoidance of harm. And there's been a lot more evidence about the things that can be in an office fit out or in the office envelope, the bit the developer investor provides, that can make a real difference to how well and therefore how productive office occupiers can be.
I think that's exactly right. If we're separating like health versus health and well-being from perhaps office harm, the way my own compliance training for health and safety is very much avoid the rusty nail and don't touch the exposed wire, neither of which that I really come across that much in a modern office environment. And so this idea that wellness and well-being is so much more important as a general environment that you're working in somewhere, I assume, you know, I imagine natural light has a, like, I like being able to face a window or being able to see that there is a world outside that I could go take a walk outside in. It does make me feel a lot better about my working day than if I was in a basement office where I would have no idea whether it's sun shining or it's torrents of rain outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And much of this is common sense as well as good science. So your example about natural light, there's ample evidence to prove that does improve someone's productivity. Part of that is to do with something called biophilia, which is a posh word to describe how people feel better when they can see nature. So you know, that's proven by medical studies, but also, you know, we all know that we feel better if we go for a walk in the woods at the weekend and see some countryside. So it's not rocket science.
Yes, no, exactly.
This makes people feel better. In terms of what this means to us as office investors and owners, it means we need to consider the windows, where the building is situated relative to nature or places for people to go to and have exercise.
Offices are so often next to other offices, so you have to think about, you know, how are you getting enough natural light? The fact that you've got windows is all very well and good, but if the window is 30 meters away from another office window, neither of you are gaining anything in the space.
Yeah, and that's also an interesting point to make at this stage. So the owner or developer can make that decision about natural light and the position and aspect of the building. The occupier can make a decision about whether they put meeting rooms around the outside of their office floor and block natural light from people working at the desks in the middle, or the converse, put people by the window. And increasingly, and it sounds obvious, but the people by the window is becoming more prevalent because of this body of evidence to suggest it's the right thing to do.
What are some other ways we can think about that? Perhaps we can think about designing offices to really help people feel better within the office environment.
There are several things to do. And again, there is a distinction between what is in the control of the occupier and what's in control of the investor. And it might be worth pausing on that point now, because a lot of people in our industry still think this is an occupier problem and solution that can only be enabled by them, and we would fundamentally challenge that. It needs to be a partnership approach between two sides. So things that are relatively simple, relatively obvious fixes are nudges towards a more healthy way of working, so more movements. We talked about that in the sense of our sedentary lifestyle. So creating a welcoming staircase in the centre of a building that people can go up and down, converse with their colleagues, and actually kind of almost enjoy the architecture and the experience, rather than a kind of fire escape tucked around the back, naming no examples. But that is increasing part of something that a landlord will put in, but also an occupier can do also with their landlord's permission. One of the most fundamental things to improve wellness is the levels of CO2 in the workspace, the carbon dioxide. And this again needs to be a partnership between landlord and occupier, owner and occupier, I should say, as the word landlord is becoming increasingly outdated. But the owner can ensure or should ensure that air circulation is at a certain standard to make sure those particulates, those CO2 concentrations don't go above a certain level. And it's not really a risk of that they go below a certain level and people start to be ill or poisoned. And certainly everything should be in place to prevent that. But it's about losing cognitive function. And you know, we've all been in meeting rooms where after a while I start to feel a bit sleepy and befuddled, and that may or may not be to do with the content of the meeting, but it's likely to have something to do with the CO2 in the room as well.
With the air circulation within the room.
Exactly, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that anything above 1,400 parts per million is bad for cognitive function, mm-hmm. and below that is better. And there's been plenty of experiments about people doing proofreading tests, yep. or other tests that show a remarkable improvement below mm. those parts. And, you know, something like 20% in some cases. So a meaningful boost to productivity.
Absolutely. Would I be wrong in extrapolating that to, I mean, in the way that we understand kind of employee benefits when you're looking at a new company? If an employer kind of advertised that we keep our air circulation very, very clean, is that something we could tangibly see in the near term of being a real, you know, incentivizer, not above all else, but a genuine benefit for employees that they can tangibly put their finger on and say, this benefits me. I would rather work at place X that does this rather than place Y that does that.
Yes, in one word answer. Yes. I can definitely...
I love these conversations.
Yeah, exactly. Let me expand on that one word answer. We will see that more and more, I think. And one of the reasons behind that is the use of wearable technology from individuals. So people are far more aware mm-hmm. of their local environment and what it's doing to them, and where there's potential harm. And they are far more willing to put their hand up and say, actually, something's not right.
It's not just for the occupier to be the ones monitoring. They have to be aware that, you know, other people can't. The technology exists for employees to be able to monitor these sort of environments.
Yes. And going back to the CO2 point, there will come a stage soon, I'm sure, where smartphones will tell you your CO2 reading for your immediate environment. I think some can do it already, but it's not ubiquitous. So when that starts happening and someone can say, okay, this room I am in is making not perform as well as I could be, the employer has to do something about that. And the risk for the investment industry is if there's a kind of series of litigation where the employee says, do something about this, the employer says, we can't, it's the investor's problem, and then someone gets sued. So that's almost a negative way of thinking about it.
The risk of not doing it is XYZ, like high profile reputational risks, legal risk.
Yeah, and I think that will come. The better mindset to take for us as investors is let's promote wellness, okay, rather than be worried about those individual risks. And you made the point about whether a building can be differentiated from another building. And yes, I can see a time soon when that does happen. If we take a high level view on that, the more thinking jobs there are out there, if I can call them that, and that will increase in time with more artificial intelligence, and the value of people who can think and analyze and predict will go up. The more valuable the space they are in becomes, because if you can demonstrate that space is enabling them to think better than a peer group or a benchmark, then you're onto something, both in terms of their ability to win business and their willingness to occupy a certain type of building. Will that result in rental differentials between two buildings? Maybe, maybe not, but there's more certainty on less investment depreciation, mm-hmm. Longer income streams. So the overall return from those buildings are likely to outperform
as
well.
So they pose a better investment for us as LGM and our clients.
Exactly.
Thank you so much. I feel like that's really laid out such a fascinating link between health and well-being and investing in property. So I'd just like to ask you both to wrap up. If I've understood this right, I feel like improving well-being makes good investment sense, both through the larger trend of the societal shift towards increased gym demand amongst certain segments, which allows us to diversify our retail exposure and help communities become better. Have I understood that part right, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just, you know, following up what Bill has just said about, you know, the emphasis on well-being, it is so important as owners to understand what is important to people at the end of the day, and that influences what we should be going into our retail assets, our leisure assets, and also how we should design our offices. So I think that kind of understanding of what drives consumer behaviour then influences how we design our assets and ultimately impacts investment yeah, investment return.
Amazing. And that feeds into the productivity gains and the occupier longevity that we can gains we can see from our office space investments.
Exactly. We want to be good investors and good landlords, effectively. And to do that, we need to manage those relationships over the length of the lease. So the industry has been guilty in the past of being arm's length. So the lease gets signed, the owner forgets about it, and maybe comes back in 5 or 10 years when it's time for a rent review or expiry. That those days are gone, and rightly so. And to make sure that space is as effective and productive as possible is a partnership. It's not relying on one side to deliver.
Exactly. It requires the community, the investment owner-occupier relationship to rethought, and for asset managers like us to really work towards community goals as much as any other. Thank you so much. There's been a fascinating conversation. If you'd like to read more about Matt and Bill's fascinating writings on the subject, they've both recently published blogs on the Future World blog. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill and Matt. And thank you. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Elgium Talks. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.